At all times, you must remain mindful of the words you use around your cat, both spoken and unspoken. The kitty curse jar concept. If you've gotten in the habit of directing ugly language at your cat, here's a solution. Establish a designated kitty curse jar. Then every time you or someone else calls your cat something like evil, devil, or bastard, put a dollar in it. Do it for a few weeks and you'll quickly become aware of how you talk about your cat and see how it can all add up. Cat daddy tip. Oh, and what do you do with the money? Buy your cat a new toy, of course. Projection. Say you're having a rough day. You wake up and immediately get into a fight with your significant other. You get a speeding ticket on your way to work. Your boss yells at you. Then you drop your lunch in your lap. Finally, you get home exhausted, humiliated, and with salad dressing pants. And the first thing you see is your cat sitting there just staring at you. All of a sudden, that frantic inner dialogue kicks in and you're like, what? What did I do? What is wrong with you? I put a roof over your head and cuddle you, and this is what I get in return? Well, screw you. The problem is, you are attempting to make an objective judgment call about what your cat is thinking from an extremely non-objective place. We call this projection. In psychology, the term is used to describe the tendency to take our own feelings, insecurities, impulses, or anger and ascribe them to others. In the above story, you were projecting your own negative feelings onto your cat, who you think suddenly hates you. Cats, in particular, are ripe for human projection because people often find them hard to read. For this reason, they become a blank canvas for us to scribble our manic ramblings on, untrue as they may be. That feline tabula rasa becomes a litany of revenge-seeking, masterminding plots on all imagined human wrongdoings. And projection doesn't even have to come from a place of anger or frustration. Sometimes we think that because we want something, like privacy when we're going to the bathroom, that our cats must want it too. Again, not true. As a result of projection, you can circle down this drain fast and often, and it is purely a result of not understanding cat life, body language, or mojo. If you keep going down that drain, however, you will continue to unnecessarily degrade your relationship with your cat. Let's not go there. As we approach the end of this section, I'm hopeful that the Cat Mojo Toolbox system has addressed almost any questions or challenge you might have imagined from the ground up. Moving forward, you'll need a system in place to maintain the mojo so that you can resolve any issues either before they happen or just after they do. This leads us to cat detectivism. Part of the reason I've been successful at walking into someone's home and solving cat problems for them is because I don't live there. I'm like a detective. I come in, observant and impartial, and I assess a problem. I'm not entwined in the storyline or any drama, projections, or heavy emotions thereof. Example, your cat has been peeing in your new boyfriend's gym bag every night he stays over. You presume your cat is saying, I hate him. But to me, pee anywhere is your cat saying, I'm anxious about my territory. As impossible as it may seem in the moment, there's no need to take it personally or create a big scene around it. That's called living in the story. Instead, we investigate the particulars of how, why, where, and when, and try to resolve the issue. As Joe Friday in Dragnet would always say, just the facts, ma'am. I call this cat detectivism. The art of detached observation will get you through a lifetime of living with your cat successfully. As humans, we don't have a decent frame of reference for what it is like to be a cat. We can't pretend we do. I'm not saying you have to be completely detached from a being you love and have a relationship with, but for their sake, you can damn well do your best. This is the cardinal rule of cat detectivism. You take the actual temperature in the room, not the exaggerated version. If you walk into the house and see a spot of pee, I need you to recognize it as urine, nothing more. Then clean it up, forgive, and move on. This will enable you to notice, manage, and diagnose any issue much quicker. Just remember to forgive and move on. Take heightened emotions out of the equation. Forgive and move on. It's a hell of a lot easier to hotwire a car when it's not already running. Not that I would know. With the cardinal rule understood, here are a few more guidelines for cat detectivism. 1. Simply describe or write down what happened in the just-the-facts style that a reporter might. It was 4 o'clock in the morning. I woke up. He was sitting on my chest. I did this. He did that. 2. If you are talking about urine issues, your best friend is a UV flashlight, otherwise known as a blacklight. You've probably seen it in detective TV shows like CSI as an invaluable tool to illuminate blood at crime scenes. Not only to pinpoint placement, but the actual spatter, the shape of the stain. This tool is just as invaluable when dealing with urine as with blood. Simply wait till sundown when you can darken the space and go for it. In many cases, sorry to say, you will probably find more stains than you thought existed. For the sake of detectivism, record that shape. For instance, little drops can signify a urinary tract infection, while marks that start vertically on furniture or the wall and pool down at the floor tell you most likely it is territorial marking. More on this in section 4. Also, consider the color of the stain under the light. The darker the stain, the fresher it is. As it fades, it signifies that you've either attempted to clean it before, or it is just older. Time breaks down the protein strands of the urine, and with that comes a lighter color. Unfortunately, since cat urine is, in part, designed to permanently mark a surface even after it is completely cleaned, there will be a white stain under the blacklight, and only under the blacklight, not perceptible to the naked eye, since it broke down the color strands of the rug as well. 3. When describing the incident, remove any part that has a qualitative element. If you say he viciously attacked you, when in reality he lightly bit or scratched in response to something like overstimulation, well, now we have some shoddy reporting gumming up the works. I've even heard the word attack ascribed to perceived intent. The Guardian felt that an attack was about to happen. This level of interpretation clearly has no part to play in detectivism. As we covered earlier, cats don't behave out of spite, or at least not our anthropomorphized definition of it. And as we have covered earlier, words matter. Step away from heightened, sensationalized, or conclusive language. Remember, we're still just gathering facts here. 4. Knowing everything you now know about the raw cat, prepare a checklist of anything that could be mojo-threatening. The checklist should address these questions. What raised your cat's anxiety? What is threatening your cat's mojo? Was there fighting? Did you run out of her favorite food? Is the carrier out? Your suitcases? Were there visitors or outside cats? 5. Prepare yourself to be patient. Trust the process because rushing things usually backfires. There are no deadlines or schedules. It just doesn't work that way. No matter how hard you try to control the clock, cat problems run on cat time, not human time. Try to be informed by the behaviors you observe. Think in terms of stress and anxiety, and log behaviors, look for patterns, and write down details. Nothing is random, and nothing is personal. All problematic behaviors are rooted in fear, anxiety, and pain, or some combination thereof. Super Deluxe Cat Detectivism, the Anti-Treasure Map. Cat detectivism is a great place to use the mojo map I introduced in Chapter 8. The mojo map now becomes the anti-treasure map, where X's mark the spot where any incidences of unwanted behavior occurred. Whether we are talking about litter box issues, aggression, or what have you, just slap an X on the exact location where it happened. And when I say exact, I mean it. Which side of the couch? In front or behind? On the left or right of the front right leg? For a good detective, the devil is in the details. Also, add a key of sorts to your mojo map. For each incident, assign the X, or colored star sticker, a number. On the side of the map, record just the facts, ma'am, time and date, any behaviors you observed before or after, and how close it was to mealtime or any other energy spikes in your home. Using all of the techniques I've listed in this section, observe and record. Stick with detached observation. Put it down on your map and build your case. If you have ruled out medical causes for the behavior, I can almost guarantee that if you just gather the X's for a number of days or weeks, remain detached, and just gather information, the anti-treasure map will emerge as X's mark not just the spots, but the patterns. You will see that random acts are anything but. Preemptive cat detectivism. If I went on TV screaming like the ShamWow guy that there were indelible tip-offs, little shortcuts I could give you in body language, gait, ear position, sleeping or eating patterns that could predict destructive incidents of peeing or aggression in your cat, you might be tempted to grab the bait. After all, most folks see their cat as a collection of symptoms, a four-legged math equation that has a universal solution. Too bad such is not the case. You now know that through the art of detachment and the science of observation, you can begin to really understand the unique how, why, where, and when behind what makes your cat do what he sometimes does. Earlier on, I made it a point that a good detective isn't entwined in the storyline that he enters into. It's crucial to understand, however, that the story matters only insofar as it furthers your ability to tell the real story. Nothing in the context of your case happens in a vacuum. That is to say, use what you know in terms of the story of your cat as only you know it. Her physical history. Her life before she got to live with you, if you're fortunate enough to have that information. And the story of trauma she's endured and how she moved through that trauma. With that information, you can apply it to the present moment in the same way a detective could be interviewing either victim, suspect, or witness, and notice that as the person is telling a story, he is tapping his foot and starting to sweat. Your unique perspective on your cat's life, with and before you, gives you incredible insights on her present, unusual behavior. Finally, the next level to aspire to, and much of what we'll be covering in the final chapters, is the preemptive side of cat detectivism. This has to do with what we can do to circumvent or avoid certain anti-mojo behaviors or actions. The thing is, it's actually much easier to bring a heightened sense of awareness to the behavior that a cat would exhibit before she acts out. This is an essential mindfulness tool to have on board, because sometimes cat detectivism isn't about saving your carpet from urine. It's about saving your cat's life. A cry for help. The cat daddy red flags. The raw cat is always on guard. That's life smack in the middle of the food chain. There's always a hunt to be had and always a chance that she may be hunted. For this reason, the very last thing cats can do is show pain. Pain equals vulnerability, and predators can smell what they perceive to be weakness. Your cat carries that stoic nature with her, along with most of the rest of her ancestors' survival tactics. That's why we have to keep an eagle eye out for her behavioral changes that may signify physical challenges emerging. The following list of behavioral red flags is by no means comprehensive, but most have presented themselves to me either in the context of my work or with my own cats. When approaching litter box issues, for example, I often talk about the concept of cats raising the yellow flag. What I'm reminding you of there is that while we are running around postulating, theorizing, and throwing all kinds of behavioral spaghetti against the wall, seeing what will stick, the cat is actually saying, "Ouch!" The upshot is, if you see something out of place, either visually, behaviorally, or just on a gut level, go to the vet. Living on the fridge or under the bed. This is a sign that something in the environment is threatening. As I mentioned, the raw cat, feeling vulnerable because of pain or illness, would also choose to hide or withdraw. Urinating or defecating outside the litter box. There are lots of possible medical reasons, including cystitis, crystals, infection, kidney disease, digestive problems, diabetes, and the list goes on. Two clues to look for that usually signify a physical component. Eliminating directly outside the litter box, sometimes by inches, and very small amounts of pee spread out by a matter of steps. Chewing on things that aren't food. See Chapter 17 for more on pica, or the eating of non-food items. Changes in behavior such as sudden onset aggression. If a person in your life suddenly had a radical change in personality, you would be concerned. If your cat is suddenly lashing out, either toward human or animal family members, there's a solid chance that, just like us, he's got a shorter fuse because he's dealing with pain or discomfort of some sort. Nighttime activity or an increase in vocalizations. Hyperthyroidism is a common medical condition in older cats that can increase activity and vocalization. Older cats who are experiencing worsening vision, hearing, or the onset of dementia may also become loud or disoriented at night when the lights go out. Itching, scratching, self-biting, or grooming to the point of baldness or irritation. We've already discussed the incredibly sensitive skin of our cats. The potential causes of these symptoms can be frustratingly wide. Allergies, food, inhalant, environmental, a skin problem or a flea infestation, or even escalating stress in the home that manifests in over-grooming. Excessive sleeping. You now know that cats don't just sleep all the time. If your cat has become completely withdrawn or lost interest in all of the things, people, or activities that once gave her joy, that is a cry for help, just as it would be for a human. 12. Whose line is it anyway? Cat parenting and the human challenge line. It's almost a cliche at this point to sum up our relationship with our animal companions by calling them our best friends. As a matter of fact, it's pretty hard to sum up the relationship in words, period. This brings to mind one of the most asked questions I receive about cats. Why does my cat bring me half-eaten prey? Is it a gift of some sort? If so, by the way, can I bring it back? Of course, just like any other most asked questions, there are multiple explanations and theories why, but that's not the point. I've always been fascinated by the gesture because I see it as being distinctly yet frustratingly double-headed. First, yes, it seems like a gift, almost like a child presenting you with a macaroni and glue portrait he made of you in his second grade art class. But there's another side based on what we know about cats. It can also be a meal. Mama cat returning to her litter with test food to encourage her young away from the nipple and to get a taste of what they should be doing on their own. In other words, that simple gesture is both child to parent and parent to child. Which is to say, relationships are complicated, and each party may have multiple roles. Even in giving them meaning beneath their labels, best friend, guardian, parent, the label you choose matters less than the effort, sacrifice, and vulnerability shown to put your money where your relational mouth is. Here's the thing. In the examples we detail throughout this chapter, it will become obvious that your cats don't always need a best friend. They need a parent. And you have to be cool with the knowledge that many times the parent will not be the most popular person in the room. I've spent much time asking you to follow me into the deeper waters of the heart, to take personal risk for the sake of building real relationships, to leave the concept of cat ownership behind and embrace the risk and reward of cat parenting. So here we are in the aforementioned deeper waters, facing a problem. Us. It's one thing to live the greeting card ideal of cat parenting, and another to live the mojo-inspiring life of a cat parent. In this chapter, I hope to guide you more fully to the side where the mojo waters run the deepest. In Chapter 9, we talked about our role in helping our cats cross key challenge lines so they can enjoy a better quality of life. And we liken this experience to helping our human children across challenge lines by making them do things, like go to school, even if they're initially afraid to, all in the name of their personal growth. Now it's time for us humans to cross a few challenge lines, particularly when our personal apprehensions overshadow the best interests of our beloved cat children. Besides, it's just the right thing to do. Perhaps you've never figured out how to get your cat into a carrier because you think she hates it so much. But what if you had a real emergency go down tomorrow and had to get her out of your home in a hurry? Or maybe the idea of medicating your cat freaks you out because you think it would freak her out to have you slip a pill down her throat every day. But if that pill ultimately meant the difference between health and sickness, or maybe even life or death, you would have to get it done, wouldn't you? Instead of avoiding those things that cats don't like, and by extension, we don't like, let's find a way to deal with them anyway. And I'm not just talking about the how-to mechanics of the dreaded activity. It's also about how you approach these procedures in order not to create bad associations for both you and your cat. And if this seems too daunting, take heart. Even under these most trying conditions, there are ways to mitigate the misery and maximize the mojo. Loving too much, beating obesity. One of the challenges with feline obesity is that we contribute to it. So many of us grew up in food equals love homes, so it's understandable that we would pass that feeling on. It pains us to deny our animal companions excessive amounts of junk food treats we know they love, so we put it squarely on our unpleasantries category. But if this food is destroying their health, denying them these excessive amounts is exactly what we must do. Companion animal obesity even parallels the human obesity crisis, with recent data suggesting similar increase in the prevalence of obesity and type 2 diabetes in children, cats, and dogs. If that fact gives you pause, consider the following. As of the writing of this book, over 58% of cats are overweight, with some 15% of cats qualifying as obese. That means, according to the Association of Pet Obesity Prevention, that 80 million U.S. dogs and cats are at increased risk for weight-related disorders, such as diabetes, osteoarthritis, hypertension, and many cancers. The number of overweight to obese cats and dogs has roughly doubled in the past 20 years. Obesity causes wear and tear on a cat's joints, which can lead to pain, irritability, and stiffness. I've seen a direct and repeated correlation between obesity and behavior problems like litter box avoidance. Because carrying all that extra weight is so uncomfortable, and squatting in or getting in or out of the box hurts, these cats have a negative association with the location. Likewise, obesity leads to a reduction in prey-based exercise because it is just too painful an operation. This inactivity continues a vicious cycle of weight gain unless we interrupt that pattern. Overweight cats have difficulty grooming themselves, which is unpleasant for cat and human alike. As you can see, folks, feline obesity is an all-out epidemic, but it doesn't have to be that way. Here's what you can do to help. 1. Stop free feeding your cats, and stop feeding your cats junk, especially dry food. They should be eating scheduled, bioappropriate meat-based meals. That means a raw diet, or at least a grain-free wet diet. 2. Use slow feeding bowls and or food puzzles to prevent them from scarfing. Just like humans, cats need a minute to register that they are full, and that can only happen if they are eating at a reasonable pace. 3. Don't forget about HCKE. Play, in conjunction with the tips above, will absolutely help get your cats to that optimal weight. They'll be happier, and because they are healthier and around longer, you'll be happier too. And as for the notion that you might fall out of favor with your cat once you put the kibosh on all that junk food, consider this. A recent study surveyed guardians who had placed their cats on a sensible eating plan. Almost all of the cats lost weight, and most of the cats became more affectionate to their guardians, getting in their laps more and purring more. So lest you think that restricting your cat's food will make him upset with you, it turns out the opposite is true. Don't fret the vet. Cat guardians generally don't take their cats to the vet half as much as dog guardians. Not only does it end up costing them more, but there are so many diseases that can be taken care of if found early. Kidney disease, diabetes, dental disease, eyesight loss, hyperthyroidism, and heart problems. These are all treatable or manageable, but the earlier you know, the easier it will be. At the very least, you should be running a senior blood panel once a year on your healthy adult cat. Sounds logical, right? So if you're not doing this, what's the holdup? Probably it's because the whole process of going to the vet is an ordeal for both you and your cat on every level. I've known an unbelievable number of cats throughout the years who have never been to the vet, period. Not once. And we're talking 10-year-old cats. Basically, it's not until I call the guardians on their folly that these cats finally see the inside of a vet clinic for the first time since they were spayed or neutered. Yet another example of how the unpleasantries can take avoidance to a new level. So how can you get on the other side of this? First, consider the destination, your vet's office. Knowing what might set your cat off in terms of his or her surroundings, certain offices might be more stressful by nature. So go and visit a few in your area. Is the environment there loud or calm? What kind of ratio of dogs versus cats do they generally have? Are there separate entrances for dogs and cats? A true litmus test is when you bring up concerns about your cat's anxiety to the staff. Are they responsive? Do they seem as if they genuinely care? I've had the pleasure of working with many a vet who, knowing that my cat is nervous, hustles us through the waiting room and into an exam room to avoid the stimulation. The point is, you don't have to settle. You have lots of options these days, so do your due diligence. So we've talked about the destination. Next, we have one of the most dreaded elements of vet visits, the double whammy of the journey, getting your cat there and getting her into a carrier. Carriers can be a cat's best friend. Over half of all cats aren't making it to the vet for a yearly exam. And over a third of cat guardians get stressed out just thinking about taking their cat to the vet. The main reason your cat doesn't like the cat carrier is because every association they've had with that box has been negative. Think about it this way. What if, as a child, you had two cars in the garage? One car, a red convertible, was used every day to take you to school, friends' houses, the movies, etc., while the other car, a yellow station wagon, was used only to take you to the dentist. After this had happened to you enough times, you made the association. So all your mom had to do was grab the keys for the station wagon and wham! Racing pulse, sweaty palms, and a deep sense of foreboding took over you. To put it gently, you would do anything in your power to keep your butt out of the backseat of that damn yellow death sentence. This is how many, if not most, cats perceive their carrier. So what do? We change the station wagon into the convertible, of course. First, we need to change the carrier from a place of dread and fear to a destination, a portable base camp. 1. Start by taking the carrier apart. Part of what will help undo the association is if it no longer resembles the yellow station wagon. Use the bottom part as a starting point and turn the carrier into a cocoon. Make it cozy with some bedding that contains the scent of both your cat and you. 2. Use treats to make that cocoon even more inviting. Give your cat a treat for any curiosity around the carrier, even if she just gives it a sniff. Remember the concept of the jackpot treats? Now is that time. While training your cat to love her new den, break out the jackpots. Break them out only around the carrier. Even better, get your cat eating her meals in the carrier. It may take a few times, moving the bowl closer and closer to her new favorite place. So have patience and push that challenge line every day. 3. Once there is a sense of predictability in terms of your cat using the carrier, not just to eat treats, but to hang out, even for small periods, it's time to begin the reconstruction. First, the top. Use the same techniques to reinforce the continued positive association. Then the door. Then close the door for short periods. Many cats are triggered simply by the sound of the latch closing. In that case, start with the latch taped open and then gradually desensitize. If you can get to the point where you can feed dinner with the door closed, the yellow station wagon is officially a red convertible. 4. Again, staying consistent with the association techniques that have worked best for you, pick up the carrier with the door closed, and of course the cat inside. Don't even go to the car the first time. Close the carrier with your cat inside and go outside for 30 seconds. Then go back in, open the carrier, put some treats inside, and let your cat try to figure out what the heck just happened. Hint, good stuff. 5. The next step would be a short car ride, just around the block. Rinse and repeat. Make sure every trip, whether short or long, whether a purely positive experience or somewhat challenging, ends with jackpot. What are we doing? We are showing your cat that being in the carrier doesn't always mean something monumentally bad happens. Being in the car doesn't always mean getting a shot or sharing a lobby with a growing number of other cats and dogs. The carrier is not the enemy. And if your cat gets in a carrier 50 times, but only one of those times he goes to the vet, not bad. The Mary Poppins Aspiration. Whether we are discussing topics like bringing your cat to the vet, putting him in a carrier, giving him medication, trimming his nails, leaving him when you go to work, feeding him meals instead of free feeding, etc., they all have an emotional connective tissue. Guilt. And this guilt is centered on the unbearable notion that we are the reason our cat is miserable, that we are causing him pain, even if that pain is momentary. Even if our avoidance of these unpleasantries would eventually spell increased misery for our cats, subconsciously, we still sweep it under the rug. The challenge line suddenly emerging in this moment is yours. The paralyzing guilt that accompanies these tasks becomes the line you must cross if you want to be the most mojorific cat parent you can be. Hey, this is a judgment-free zone. Believe me, if I'm shining a light on something here, it's because I've had to cross this line too. How do we cross our challenge line and simultaneously get our cats to accept the nail trimming, vet visiting, pill taking, and every other unpleasantry? As Mary Poppins would say, a spoonful of sugar helps the medicine go down. Why the Mary Poppins reference? As it turns out, she represents both the calming persona and the skilled nanny. She knows all about the intricacies of getting done what has to be done, but is also mindful about the way she does it. This is an excellent model for every cat parent to follow. A spoonful of sugar. The guilt that we feel permeates both the tone of our voice and the words that we choose when trying to get through these various activities. As we just discussed in the last chapter, words matter. In truth, so does the rest of it, from the tone to physiology. If you treat it like a big deal, it becomes a big deal. If you are in the midst of doing one of these uncomfortable things with your cat, like giving him a pill, for example, and your inner monologue is, "My cat is miserable, I'm making him miserable, I'm a bad parent," you will most likely manifest a tone, an anxious energy that your cat will feel. Now you find yourself tiptoeing toward your cat, fists clenched around the medicine bottle or nail trimmers, every muscle from your shoulders to your jaw tightened as you verbalize, "Okay, baby, this is not going to be a big deal at all." That's where Mary Poppins comes in. A spoonful of sugar is the idea that we let go of the angst and consciously bring the sweetness to a stressful situation. We do things in the most delightful way. This is how we mitigate the misery. Helps the medicine go down. I can't know what the big red button inside you is that brings you to your challenge line. We took you through methods for dealing with various challenges, such as getting your cat to the vet, for instance. But when it comes to your specific sweat-inducing task, it's a pretty individual thing. Is it nail trimming? Pill giving? Simply leaving the house for 10 hours? Switching food? Whatever it is, your goal is a true sense of ease in establishing an everyday context for the task. And here's where the skilled nanny element comes into play. This is all about getting more competent and confident about the mechanics of a given task, particularly those where you feel resistance. The way to do this: 1. Define your challenge line moments. 2. Research methods to turn these moments into step-by-step tasks. Your due diligence, of course, includes online research, but don't forget to mine the knowledge and experience of your local pet professionals. Your vet, vet tech, groomer, or pet sitter can either demonstrate or offer valuable info about the how-tos. 3. There are many methods. Find the one that resonates for you. For example, there are more animal nail trimmers on the market than I can possibly count. In the meantime, using ordinary human nail clippers works so comfortably for me that when I grab them, because I know what to do with them, my anxiety is immediately lowered. 4. Use the concept of the fire drill I laid out in Chapter 10. If, before you even approach your cat, you have gone through the process so many times in your head, thinking about how you would react if things went sideways, so that there aren't many surprises that can happen in the actual moment, you'll be more able to release the stress you feel. 5. Take a moment before you approach your cat to ground yourself. Go through your fire drill. Take a few breaths. Consciously do a quick body check to become aware of where you are holding your physical stress and release it. When you combine both of these Poppins attributes, the what you do and the how you do it, you transform what was once a necessary but dreaded activity into yet another modified interaction you experience with your cat, another slice of life, this time set to your musical mantra: a spoonful of sugar helps the medicine go down. Now, you could just be walking by your cat, bend down as if you're petting her to say hi, and give her a pill. A flash of magic. She won't know what hit her. To treat or not. Another very individualized component of this process is the reward. Could you offer a jackpot treat after giving a pill? Of course, and that's a part of your fire drill. Whatever it takes to get you to feel absolutely nonchalant about the process. How many times have I personally done that? None. For these objectively small tasks, the reward portion of the proceedings actually made me more stressed because it heightened the significance of the event. In my experience, the better I got at the steps I outlined above, the more my fire drill became muscle memory, and the less I wanted to make it into a rewardable action. In my view, there is a connection between the tension-fueled, "It's okay, baby, this is so not a big deal" vibe before the action, and making a big deal about how great she is for doing this and how beautiful it is after the fact. The bigger the reward you give her for this action, the more you're also setting it up as a big operation. A small, matter-of-fact operation calls for a small, matter-of-fact appreciation. That said, it is your challenge line, which makes it your process. The key to figuring out your strategy is mindfulness and preparation. Whatever falls between those lines that works for both you and your cat works for me too. Lifelong Mojo, a spoonful of sugar for kittens. If you have a kitten, all of these unpleasant activities we have to do for our cats are opportunities. Set up a lifelong dynamic now, because if they need a pill today, they're probably going to need a pill later. If you burrito them, scruff them, or sit on top of them, you're making it so that there is going to be a boomerang effect. Every time you go through the action of giving them a pill, they're going to struggle harder. Therefore, you are best served to find a way within yourself to stay centered. When people do something that they perceive their cats don't like, they tend to overdo it, or don't do it at all. Either way, you are not doing anybody any favors. Keeping cats indoors. If there's one topic that causes fights to break out, and I mean of the human variety, it's whether or not cats should be allowed outdoors. The indoor-outdoor debate centers on the concept of quality versus quantity, the idea that cats' lives are of a better mojo quality when given access to their original stomping grounds, and that cats love being outside, and it goes against nature to restrict their movements. At the same time, if they are given that free access, dangers abound and their lifespan can be shortened. To be fair, both sides of the fence here make very strong arguments. Are cats innately happier when allowed access to the outdoors? I believe so. Are there problem-solving opportunities and challenges from both their environment and through practicing the raw cat HCKE that are difficult to replicate? Again, yes. Some say cats need to be outside, and by denying that, we're making their lives miserable. In the same breath, people acknowledge that the threats outside are numerous and can be fatal. Between the transmission of diseases like FIV that come from the inevitable fights with other community cats, and the usual suspects of cars, people, and predators from both air and ground, it's rough out there. Where do I fall in the debate? I believe that cats should be kept indoors. I don't believe that we should even be getting into the debate about quality versus quantity of life. We can replace the perceived loss of quality by involving ourselves in our cats' lives more. My personal model of parenting dictates that I want my animal children around for the full natural duration of their lives. Do they love being out there? No debate. But I loved riding the subway around New York as a teenager. I still had a curfew. That said, it's a personal choice whether you're going to let your cat be indoor or outdoor. But if you do fall on the outdoor side of things, consider at least these additions to you and your cat's lives, which will give them access to the outdoors, but keep them safe at the same time. Catio. This is a real game changer. A catio is basically a space that you can make for your cats, which of course you can share with them, by enclosing your existing patio or creating an enclosure. There, you can offer great vertical spaces, wooden objects that they can scratch on, different grasses including catnip that you can plant and they can enjoy, even hunting that can happen when critters make their way inside. Harness training. Enjoying the great outdoors via a leash isn't just a dog thing. If your cat demonstrates that he really, really wants to get outside, not just because you think he should get out there, he can be trained to a harness and leash, and you can spend quality time every day cruising around the neighborhood with your cat. Window boxes. Sometimes, you can't even take them outside because of your schedule or your apartment lifestyle, or you determined that they didn't want to go out badly enough to train to a harness. Or perhaps, once they were trained, the outdoors just wasn't for them. There are kits that fit in your window just like an air conditioner that allow your cats to enjoy the view. Getting in the window box can become a wonderful hangout spot with a front row seat to cat TV. Fencing in backyard. There are several companies offering different versions of the existing fairly foolproof method of fencing in your backyard. You can attach toppers to your existing fences or purchase a freestanding system. Either way, your cats won't get out, and just as important, nobody else can get in. Still want to let them out? At least make sure your bases are covered just in case. Consider the following. Letting cats outside responsibly. Please make sure your cats are microchipped and have their ID tag and a breakaway collar. Make sure they're up on their vaccines. Let your cat out only when you are home, so if your cat needs you, he can find you. When the sun goes down, your cat comes in. Stop free feeding. Have mealtimes so your cats will come home at certain times, and again, you retain a measure of control about when they are out and when they are in. Take the most amazing pictures of your cats in color, black and white, all angles. If they get lost, you will want those pictures for the flyers you hand out around your neighborhood. Be aware of how your cat might affect other cats. If your neighbors have a Napoleon cat who's indoors only, and your cat poops in their yard, that can drive Napoleon so berserk that he will paint their house with pee. In that case, if you want to be a good neighbor, take your cat out on a harness or keep your cat indoors. The last stop, saying goodbye with love and grace. I was doing a speaking engagement in Milwaukee a few years back. It was at the Pabst Theater, an absolutely magical place. The night itself is one I will never forget for a few reasons. It was a full house and the vibe was, for lack of a better word, ecstatic. Most performers can point to a few times in their lives when they felt such an intense connection with their audience that the line between them just melted away. For me, that night in Milwaukee was that moment. Bonding over a love for cats, celebrating that relationship together, made it into a two-hour, 1,200-person family reunion. Riding this natural high of give and take from audience to stage and back again, I launched into my traditional end-of-night Q&A. A microphone was set up in the center aisle of the theater with a single spotlight on it. A line quickly formed that went from the center of the theater all the way down the aisle to the doors. After answering a few questions, mostly about pee and poop, naturally, I saw that at the mic was a little girl who seemed to me to be about 10 years old, small enough that she was partially obscured from view by the mic stand. She was clearly shy, uncomfortable to be standing in front of all these people. I remember thinking that whatever she had to ask me must be important, because her body language was telling me she'd rather be any place but in front of that mic, under that spotlight, looking through the darkness up to me on the stage. I also remember that the previous question and answer had left the place a little raucous, laughter lingering from the exchange between me and the person who'd asked the question. But when she stepped up, I felt a quiet overtake the place, as though a small wind had gathered everyone's words from their lips and blown them all out the windows to scatter with the light snow on East Wells Street. She shuffled her feet and started asking her question, but it was completely indecipherable. I asked her to speak up. Then she said, "Jackson, I have a cat at home. I've known her since I was born. She's 15 years old. She's my best friend, and she's really not well. I know she's unhappy and kind of scared. When's the right time to let her go?" And then the room got really, really quiet. The courage of that little girl staggered me. Talk about walking the walk. It was so important for her to know how to help her friend and herself through the hardest time of both of their lives, that she put herself on the line for me, a stranger, in front of 1,200 other strangers. Her innate sense of generosity toward her friend made me want to cry. I didn't. She needed a strong presence, and I wanted to be what she needed. For the next 10 minutes, it was just me and her, and what I felt like I owed her. The truth. You knew we had to go here together, right? For all of us who have shared our lives with animals, we know what it feels like to be that girl, standing in a void, throwing that question up to the universe. When is it time? When is it time to say goodbye to a companion animal? This question cuts to the heart of our end of the deal when it comes to the unconditional love that animals show us. We have the ability to show them mercy at a time when they may be asking for that mercy. We have to remember that the spirit of euthanasia is probably best defined by its literal translation from the Greek, a kind death. In the spirit of full disclosure, my views on the subject are, like everyone else's, built on my experiences. I worked at an animal shelter for almost 10 years. I continue to keep my feet as rooted in the world of animal welfare as I possibly can, so the concept and experience of euthanasia is very much a part of my process. At my shelter, we performed euthanasia as a service to guardians. Some would choose not to be present, but the majority did what we highly encouraged, which was to be there with and for their companion. In the course of my years there, I came across more unfortunate reminders of the human challenge line than I even care to remember. I don't think it's necessary to spell it out in graphic detail, except to tell you that my job, comforting an animal at the end of life as well as assisting in the passing, sometimes left a bitter taste in my mouth. Guardians who loved their animals so much and were so afraid of losing them found themselves paralyzed and unable to see their friends suffering in front of their eyes. Sometimes this mother of all challenge lines, left uncrossed, caused a guardian to keep her companion alive too long, which resulted in an inability to be present for the last moments. But every time the result was the same. A stranger had to step in to show mercy and be a loving presence because the guardian simply could not. The irony of that situation playing out time and again solidified my approach to that night in Milwaukee and gave me an unflinching answer to the courageous girl at the mic. Never on their worst day. It's a fine line and a loaded statement for sure, but it has served me well over years of loving and losing animal companions and counseling many people through their process. It's not meant to be literally dissected. It's a way of keeping yourself in check while trying to stay completely present so that you can, in a clear-headed way, make one of the most difficult decisions you may ever have to make. I keep the phrase in my mind to help bring me back to the moment, like snapping a rubber band I keep around my wrist. Snap. It's not about me. Snap. It's not about my pain or suffering. Snap. It's not about how I will fall apart in the days and weeks after losing my best friend. It's about them. One of the things that makes this final decision so hard is not necessarily the finality of it all. Rather, it's the concept that their worst day is actually a little more subjective than it might seem. To me, it's not just about their declining physical state, the collapse of the body. Beyond that, there's an essential dialogue that is always struggling to take place. Desires that want to be heard, as long as you are in a space where you can be available to it. Does this mean that your cat will tell you when it's time? In my experience, yes. It just may not look or sound like what you'd expect. As with any very close familial relationship, you've developed a language together. During times like this, however, the communication can be very quiet and the gestures minute. Again, it's all about presence. And presence can only happen when your mind, your needs, and your fears are all safely on the back burner. Part of my personal process is rooted in my belief that we are all transient. We are all spirits taking a pit stop in physical form. The process of letting go of an animal companion is, in part, about shepherding him to the next place. When I think about never on their worst day, I am also thinking about their transition into another form. I want their last memories of this particular time around to be of love and light, not pain and suffering. I also believe that, unless they feel a bit of emotional detachment on your part when tuning into this sacred bond, they won't feel permission to make that transition. If they feel like you're still holding on, they might hold on longer than is good for them. Yes, that means that crying happens in another room, along with any other display that doesn't serve them in that particular moment. I'm not in any way saying that there isn't a place for science or medicine, that there shouldn't be a measure of fight to help save their lives. That said, no doctor, no friend, no family member can know your animal's inner emotional and physical life better than you can. It is often a solitary decision. You are their protector from fear and from suffering. That's the deal you made with that animal the day you became his guardian, and in return, he gave you his unconditional love. That love comes with a price, and this is it. Obviously, there is no clean yes or no answer to one of the most complex, heart-shattering scenarios we will have with our cat companions. But remember that what we've built through the course of this book together is a toolbox, a heart-shaped container for all the tools that are contained here. Use the tools and stay mindful of your empathetic center, and you will be guided to steer clear of the endless, torturous inner conversations or arguments about whether it's too early or too late. You will also be guided toward that final bonding moment of peace and light. I know that was a tough subject to tackle, but part of what we are doing here is stopping to examine and question all that we thought we knew about our animal companions. In this section, we looked at our own challenge lines and fearlessly put one brave foot in front of the other so that we might transcend those lines. Now that we've taken a deep breath, reaffirmed our relationship, and checked the stability of our toolbox and the tools that live inside, we are truly ready to put all that we have to the test as we solve the most common cat problems known to us. Section 4. The Cat Mojo Cookbook. Cat Daddy Solutions for Industrial Strength Issues. 13. When excessive scratching becomes an issue. Cat Daddy Recipe Number 1. Mojo Scratch Master. The problem. The corner of your sofa has become a cat art display of shredded fabric. One side of your expensive mattress looks like it's been dragged down a gravel road at 90 miles per hour. The legs of your favorite coffee table are beginning to look like dinosaur toothpicks. And it's all driving you out of your mind. In short, your cat is scratching everywhere but on his beautiful scratching post, which remains in pristine condition in the corner of your family room. The reality. You can't make these impulses go away. As discussed in Section 2, scratching is an innate activity that cats must partake in. Furthermore, you actually want them to do it. Not just because it's a physical need, but because of the mojified choice the cat is making. Scratching is a confident exercise, one that marks territory in a self-assured way. Unconfident marking would mean peeing on the corner of the couch instead of scratching there. You can, however, reshape and redirect these impulses so that they are more acceptable to you and your shared household. Cat Daddy Solutions. Scratching problems are generally resolved through use of my no/yes tool, as introduced in Chapter 9. In this case, we're saying no to scratching the furniture, but yes to scratching the right type of scratching post. Here's my recommended process. 1. Do your detective work and observe their scratching style. First, we have to make sure that the scratching post we use will accommodate the specific way your cat scratches. Surface preference is often at least one reason why they refuse to use the scratching post you might already have on hand and could explain why the couch suits their needs better. So, let's say it's your couch that's getting the worst of it. Observe the sturdiness of the couch. When your cat reaches way up, then pulls down, stretching out their pec muscles, removing those sheaths of nail, and doing all the things that are natural exercise to a cat, that couch is not going anywhere. So sturdiness would be a primary reason why your cat prefers the couch over the scratching post. Notice the texture of the couch and the fabric that it's made of. Is it notably different from what's on the existing scratching post? Or, if you're planning on bringing in a new scratching post, take note of the texture so you can find a suitable replica. 2. Discourage the scratching. Since the basic principle of the no/yes is that you have to give them a no before you give them a yes, it's okay to tell your cat you don't want her to scratch your couch. One of the things I really love about this approach is that it's the environment itself, not you, that tells her no by making the locations unpleasant to scratch. There is double-sided tape you can use that's designed to deter cats from furniture. But tinfoil, plastic office runners, or silky fabric furniture coverings also work just fine as temporary deterrents. I think one of the main reasons I get the, oh, hell no, look when I suggest this solution is that it is perceived as the end product as opposed to part of the process. The no is a learning tool. It is meant to be temporary as long as the yes is equally strong. When you have established a good pattern of yes on the scratching post, you can slowly start removing the no. 3. Consider the placement/location of the post. Bring the yes scratching post to the immediate vicinity of the no, the furniture they've been scratching. It will no doubt be in proximity to where you, the human, spend a lot of time. That's why your couch and your bed are the number one and two most popular scratching targets, because your scent is so strong in both. Scratching is a way of complementing your scent with theirs. It's a way of marking, in a visual and olfactory sense, a piece of furniture that is equally owned by both of you. 4. Bring in the appropriate scratching post. Now for the yes, the actual post. As mentioned, the type and style will be contingent on where/how they've been scratching. So let's start with our couch scratching example. You will need a scratching post that is tall enough and with a base wide enough to accommodate the way your cat scratches the couch. Think sturdy, similar texture, etc. One serious complaint I have with many of the standalone scratching posts on the market is that they are almost built to wobble and are barely tall enough for a kitten. When shopping, imagine your cat stretching up as far as he can go. Then add 6 to 10 inches and a base that's at least 20 inches square. If the bottom of your couch has a low clearance, you can wedge the base of the scratching post under the couch itself or under one of the feet of the couch so that the post doesn't wiggle when it's scratched. Now, you've created something that serves the purpose of proximity and also provides the right scratching tool. 5. Encourage use. You can encourage your cat into the scratching position by dragging a toy along the scratching post or using catnip or a treat to lure him to it. Whatever you do, don't force the issue. Carrying your cat to the post and moving his paws against the surface is a surefire way to annoy him. Here's another hint that has worked for me in attracting cats to the scratching post. While rubbing catnip on the post is a common trick, I think it is a bit hit or miss. But rubbing anything with your scent on it, i.e. a worn shirt or a used towel, has worked much more often for me since it helps to accomplish the desired result for your cat, which is a mingling of scents. 6. Positive reinforcement. To help lock in the new scratching protocol, give your cat praise and treats when she uses the post. Remember to save jackpot treats only for these times of initial training so the association is unmistakable. Notes from the chef. A. Check out Chapter 8 for an even more thorough explanation on scratching and post options. B. If you're really struggling with the aesthetics of a scratching post and how it interfaces with your home environment, get creative and find something that speaks to your aesthetic. No excuses. For inspiration, check out my book, Catify to Satisfy. There you will find an abundance of cool scratching post ideas inspired by fellow cat guardians like you. C. Always keep your cat's nails trimmed. A few more odds and ends. What about discouraging kneading as well? I'm not a fan of stopping cats from kneading. It's a sign of love and trust that comes from a very deep place. Kneading, also known as making biscuits and smurgling, among other terms, is a behavior that starts very soon after birth. The kneading action, when performed on mom, stimulates the delivery of milk through her mammaries. Talk about a raw cat ritual. Of course, if it's an issue, you can keep a soft blanket on your lap to prevent your cat's nails from digging into your legs. How about the use of soft paws / nail caps? I consider nail caps a last resort. You really shouldn't do it unless you have to. You still need to trim your cat's nails. The caps can be tricky to size, and they pop off when the nail grows, so you need to reapply them. I prefer you accommodate the raw cat with scratching options and let her assert herself territorially rather than trying to stop her from scratching. What about having my cat declawed as a solution for all this scratching? Absolutely not. No, never, ever, under any circumstances. Read on for more info on declawing. Declawing. Don't do it. We love our cats. We share our beds with them. We keep their photos on our phones. We cry when they are sick and mourn like nothing else when they die. But in the United States, an estimated 25% of cat guardians still elect to have their cats declawed. In case you're not exactly sure what declawing is, let me make it crystal clear. Declawing is the amputation, either by a guillotine, laser, or scalpel, of the end of a cat's toes up to the first joint. Don't do it. When cats are declawed, they experience incredible pain, both immediately after the surgery, which is often used as a procedure to test pain medication, and due to long-term phantom pain. Declawed cats are deprived of natural behaviors. They can't mark their territory in an appropriate way. They can't stretch their back muscles. They can't climb trees to escape predators, and painful paws are not going to make kneading during a loving moment very enjoyable. When cats' toes are amputated, you are changing how they walk because cats naturally walk on their toes. Declawed cats pay the price later on with arthritis. Imagine having to walk hunched over for your entire lifetime. A recent study out of Tufts University, published in the Journal of Feline Medicine and Surgery, illuminated some of the complications that arise when cats are declawed. Over half of the 139 declawed cats in the study suffered from a shoddy surgery, where fragments of bone were left behind in their paws, no doubt causing a permanent and painful pebble-in-the-shoe sensation for those cats. Furthermore, declawed cats were more likely to suffer from